This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
I always wanted to be in charge of my own destiny. I thought this is what I was born to do, you know.
You felt that. How did you feel that?
Because like my whole body, my whole spirit changes when I'm in the kitchen or when I'm at the farmer's market.
Do you think it's possible to get started in a field if you're a little too old and you can't have the time to learn the ABCs of your craft?
I really think it is important to learn the basics really well. But I think in these days, imagination is even more important.
Wolfgang Puck, I almost don't know how to introduce you because it feels like too small to say the first celebrity chef. That's like very Hollywoodish way to introduce you. You're an inspiration for defining success, not by the business empire you clearly run or, you know, the brand around your name, but your just love and passion for cooking since the age of 14 or earlier and how you just single-mindedly pursued and expanded that interest in every way, going from apprentice to chef to chef in Indianapolis, to LA, to starting restaurants, to expanding those restaurants, to expanding your name into other brands, to building the fastest-growing catering empire. You cater the Oscars. You've won all these Michelin awards. You're doing a masterclass right now on cooking, which interweaves, as we were just saying, cooking, recipes, business philosophy, and how they're all interconnected. You have 100 or so restaurants, but Cut is downtown here in New York City. So many impressive things you've done, but let's start off. Let's get you down to little Wolfgang Puck at the age of 14.
You know what's very interesting? Sometimes, you know, when you don't have the happiest childhood, maybe you have to work harder to become successful and show to your me, it was my stepfather who was totally crazy. I called him a terrorist, really, for the family. And so I could not wait to get out of the house. Like, he always told me I was good for nothing because I didn't want to become a carpenter or a mechanic or whatever. And I loved cooking as a kid already because my mother was a chef too. So I cooked with her. And
what did you love cooking at the age of 14?
I loved the sweets mostly, more so. But I liked the fried chicken, the Wiener Schnitzel and things like that, what we made at home. But desserts was really my favorite thing to do.
What dessert?
Well, we made like the Sachertorte, and we made like a Kugelhopf, like a vanilla chocolate cake, like for Sunday morning. And we made palachinken, which are thin crepes stuffed with apricot marmalade and a little powder sugar on top.
Is that at any of your restaurants? I want that.
We make one called Kaiserschmarrn, which is like a little bit like a pancake, and then you tear it up with raisins in it and everything and caramelize it with a little sugar, and we used to serve it with a plum or apple compote, you know, like
apricot what?
A compote. A compote okay. Is like when you cook the fruits with a little sugar, a little vanilla, a little lemon, and the Kaiserschmarrn is hot and the other one is cold. So that's how we ate at home a lot. We know we didn't have a lot of money. We had meat once a week. That was it. And my mother was an excellent cook. So when she wanted something, she went out in the garden, got some vegetable, made a great vegetable soup. Or in the springtime on Sunday, we had fried chicken because we didn't need all the little roosters, so because they didn't lay any eggs. So
would you chop off the head of the chicken?
My grandmother and my mother did, yeah. It was a weird thing, them grabbing the thing and just cut the head off.
So you know, that kind of... We're going to go back and forth in time, and I'm going to go on tangents. Excuse me if I go on too many tangents, but we'll always get back to the core. But what strikes me in a lot of your discussions about cooking is how much you work with the environment you're in, the time you're in, like the season you're in. You're very much about the... I feel there's a deeper philosophical lesson in your cooking, which is that things are temporary. So some food exists in the summer, some food exists in the spring, but many restaurants ignore that. They kind of try to block out the ongoing pace of time, and you don't. You very much respect the temporal nature of your ingredients, and you work with what nature delivers you. And it sounds like you learned that at the age of 14.
I know. You know, I started out for us, when I grew up in Austria, we had salads, or we had peas, or we had berries that was for the summertime. You know, in the fall, we had apples and pears and fruits. And then in the wintertime, we had very little. We had a vegetable cellar where we keep the potatoes, carrots, and the celery and stuff like that. But we didn't have a lot of fresh vegetables. So my mother made a lot of noodle dishes and things like that.
So in your restaurants, I think you still often follow that philosophy. Your philosophy.
Exactly. So in the restaurant, it's the same. Even in life, it's my philosophy is to live the moment. Not to live in the past and not to live in the future. Obviously, you can look in the future, but to live the moment. So what this means to me is, what is the best at that moment? So if we go to the farmer's market, or to the fish market, what is the best? You cannot get everything really at its peak all the time. And I was up in school at Harvard, and one guy came up to me and says, you know, the strawberries, and I had strawberries and cheese, and they both tasted like nothing. I said, only a guy like you would eat strawberries in February, I wouldn't even attempt to do that. You know,
okay, but let me ask you on that. I'm sorry to interrupt. I'll try not to. But you have your frozen foods, which is another huge empire. Yeah. I feel like you figured out from your early beginnings as a chef how to expand and scale your brand and philosophy in every direction. So you have a frozen foods empire. Yeah. Does that go against the philosophy a little bit?
No, I think we all need convenience food. You know, even the richest people will have a pizza at home or have a soup at home, which they don't make. So I think, to me, I want to be the best in each class. So if I want to make a soup, or if I want to make a pizza, or if I want to make anything different, I want it to be better than what is out there, for sure. So I have a lot of people actually who came to me and say, oh, thank you, you know, but I had nothing at home to eat. I opened your can of soup and it was amazing. In school, a guy was sick in class, and then he went to a store to buy some soup. He bought my chicken noodle soup, and he brought me the soup, and everybody in the class said, oh my God, you are making canned soup too? So I said, yeah, we do different things.
So how do you, I'm assuming you're personally involved in the ingredients and how these things, how do you separate yourself out from just a generic Campbell's soup or something? What makes your frozen foods has a tendency, I think, and then this is the last question about frozen foods. Frozen foods has a tendency, I think, to kind of all just be universally the same, generic. How do you make yours stand out? Because they do. They're amazing.
Yeah. So what I do really is use the best ingredients for that too. For example, if I make the pizza and it has some tomato sauce on it, so I buy the tomatoes in the summer and buy a really ripe one. And then we make the sauce out of that. So that way I can freeze them. I basically just cook them down and then put it in the freezer. So I have them after for the rest of the year. But the flavor is still better than if I would go out now and buy these tomatoes, which were never ripe, you know, which has no flavor, no nothing.
So you think a lot of companies just kind of take whatever, they ship it around the world, they just take whatever is available then?
Totally, totally. People don't care about the season. You know, these are most of these industries are like commodities. You know, they don't care where the tomatoes come from. They don't care how the tomatoes were farmed. You know, we use all organic ingredients. So people don't really care that much. And it's sad to think that in this world, people don't care what they put in their body, you know? And I think to me, that's one of the most important things, because if you don't eat right, you know, you might get sick. You never know.
It's the fuel to live.
It should be a good thing for you. You know, we put premium gasoline in our car and then we eat shitty food.
Yeah. And so it seems like by working with what nature gives you, that's all you're kind of saying. It's almost like a conversation you're having with nature when you create this food. So you're kind of like, nature's telling you, what I am serving to you, Wolfgang, right now is what will give the body the most energy, as opposed to if you eat a strawberry in February. And that's the that's the philosophy. That's the ingredients and seasonings you work with in your restaurants.
Yeah, totally. You know, we use whatever is really in season. And, you know, if we don't have it, we don't have it. And people sometimes look at me and says, why you don't have a strawberry pie now. I said, it's February, you know, we don't serve strawberries now. So, we wait until, in California, we are lucky, we get them in end of March, April already because of the weather. So, but then we get them from the farmer. I have a farmer, Harris Berry. I turn them on to friends of mine. Now they come with me to the farmer's market because they never had strawberries like that. And the thing is, you cannot keep them for 2 weeks. Now they harvest them in the supermarket. They harvest them and they are not ripe. They are hard like a rock and no flavor. But this one, you can smell them. It's like a total different experience.
What I love about hearing you speak right now, it's like infectious in the sense that you run, I don't know how many billions dollars worth empire. You cater to the Oscars. You're opening up all these restaurants. And yet, what you love doing is finding the local farmer, going to the farmer's market, thinking about these ingredients. So this reels us back in time again. 14 years old, you're working in your first kitchen as an apprentice. You do the correct thing and drop out of some stupid high school or whatever and start really doing what you love, what you care about. Like, how did you grow in your love for this? Because you could have gone in any direction at the age of 14.
It almost went in the wrong direction because I left my home and my father told me always, my stepfather said, oh, you're good for nothing. You're going to come back home anyway. And I said, I will never come home again. And then I left with my little suitcase. It was 50 miles away where it was. At that time, we didn't have telephone or anything. So if I wanted something, I had to write a letter to my mother. And then I get in this different town and I started to work there. And on a Sunday lunch, we ran out of potatoes. And the chef told me, you have to go home. You know, you're fired, go back home.
He blamed you for running out of potatoes?
Yeah.
I was wondering about that because you told the story. Were you supposed to buy the potatoes?
No, I was supposed to peel them and cook them.
That's it.
But I was 14 years old and like 5 foot tall.
So you peeled them too thickly?
No, so we ran out of potatoes. Potatoes is a big side dish in Austria. You know, we eat a lot of mashed potatoes and just steamed potatoes and so on. So in the middle of service, there were no more potatoes. So the chef freaked out. The sous chef came and started screaming at me. At the end of service, the chef called me over and said, you're fired. You know, you ran out of potatoes. And I said, I didn't know how much potatoes we need. I just started a month ago. And then I said, I'm not going home. It was really crazy. So I said, I'm going to kill myself. I'm not going home. So I went on the river. There was a big river with a big high bridge going. So I said, I'm going to just jump in the river. So I was standing for an hour on the bridge, looking down and seeing, it was early winter, and seeing the ice swimming down the river and some wood things swimming down. And I looked and looked. And I said, I'm going to jump. And then at the end, something lit up in my head, and I said, I'm just going to go back tomorrow and see what happened. So I arrived the next morning in the restaurant, and the apprentice who was ahead of me was all excited because he didn't want to clean the kitchen or he didn't want to peel potatoes and onions and everything. He hid me down in the vegetable cellar. And then 2 weeks later, the chef used to come down in the cellar and sees me sitting on a milk crate down there peeling carrots. And he said, what the heck are you doing here? I fired you. Go home to your mother. I said, I'm not leaving. He grabbed me. He tried to pull me physically out. I dug in my heels and said, I'm not leaving. And then he didn't know what to do. He obviously was like a scene. He was yelling and everything. I'm good for nothing. Go back home. And then at the end, he called the owner of the restaurant and said, you know, I don't know what to do with this kid. I fired him. He should go home to his mother. But he doesn't want to leave. And the owner said, well, maybe I send him to the other hotel we have and maybe he can start there. So I said, okay, that sounds better. I'm not going home. And then I left and I started to work in the other place, in the other hotel. And there, the chef was a woman. And she told me basically, said, okay, just do your job. Don't make any noise and everything will be fine. And so and then it started to get better. And about a year later, we went to school.
Well, you started to get better. I feel like there's obviously a lesson in here, which is not only don't kill yourself and go back to work, but there's some element of perseverance. Like this, your father told you you were good for nothing. The chef then, that you looked up to and you were working for and you love cooking, the chef essentially told you you were good for nothing. Yeah. And what made you inside feel like, okay, there's something in me that wants to cook. You didn't even look for another job in another industry, which you could have found, I'm sure, even at the age of 14. What made you really deep down want to go back? Did you want to prove yourself to your father, to the chef?
I think part of it was me. That's what I really wanted to do, even at that young age. And, you know,
how could you tell? How do people know?
Because I had no idea about anything else, maybe, or I didn't think about anything else.
Was it love for mother?
Maybe the love from the mother. And my mother was like an angel. She was amazing. But I think for me, cooking was it. I didn't want to become a mason or a carpenter or things like that. I used to hate that. That I knew because my stepfather was building the house by year. He added on things. Whenever he had money, he built a little bit on or did something. And he always had me work with him, and I hated it.
And yet I can feel like you might, like, given what you said, you might have liked that just because, again, he's using the ingredients of nature to build, you know,
I didn't like him.
That's
so
the problem.
That was the big problem. Yeah. And I think my mother was amazing and I loved her and she loved me and my grandmother too. So I think it was the connection really I had with her, which made me like what she was doing. And I think that's probably a big reason why I went into cooking. If my father would have been really nice to me and shown me how to do things right instead of yelling at me all day long or make me do things, I think, on purpose that where the other kids were playing football or soccer or something and I had to go and work with him, it was not a good thing.
And once you started being essentially the apprentice of the apprentice, you were young enough, you could take the time to learn these extremely basic skills, but very well. Peeling potatoes, peeling carrots, gathering the natural ingredients from the area or going to the farmer's markets or whatever. Like you were able to put in this time at a young age when not that many responsibilities were expected from you to learn these basic skills. Do you think it's possible to get started in a field if you're a little too old and you can't have the time to learn the ABCs of your craft?
I really think it is important to learn the basics really well. But I think in these days, imagination is even more important. And after I did my apprenticeship, I went to France. And at that time, I still wasn't sure because the money was so small, didn't get paid a lot. And a friend of mine was a truck driver, and he made five times more money. So I said,
and not only that, he ate his steaks well done.
Yeah. So I said, maybe I'm going to do that just because of the money. But when I was in south of France in a restaurant called Beaumanière, there, the owner was 72 years old. And he had this passion for cooking. He had six gardeners. He had a lot of land, so they grew all the vegetables there. He had olive orchard. He had a vineyard. So he made his own olive oil and so forth. But what was amazing with him, he was a president of an insurance company, but he always loved to cook. So one day he says, okay, I'm going to follow my passion. And then he opened this restaurant called Beaumanière. And by the time he was 58 years old, he had a three-star restaurant, the highest accolade you could get in France for a restaurant is 3 stars in the Guide Michelin. And so it shows that if you have passion and you love something, that you really can excel at whatever age it is. Now, I tell everybody, you have to have imagination and the techniques, you can learn them as you go along, so that's not as difficult. But imagination is very few people have it.
Can you develop the nuances of imagination if you don't know the basics? Like you knew the basics so well, what seasonings would go with what seasonings, how to cut all the different. Not that cutting is such an amazing skill, but you learned all these extreme basics. Those are like the tools, the building blocks of imagination. Can you have that imagination without the building blocks?
You know, you have to know a little bit for sure. But like, for example, my son Byron is 23 years old. He graduated from Cornell. And
I went to Cornell.
Oh, yeah.
Good job.
Yeah. So now I send him to restaurants to learn how to cook because at Cornell, the hotel school there is not for cooking, you know.
But a very good hotel school.
Very good hotel school, the best one in the world probably, or the most famous one in the world. And now I send him to places like in Spain with the Roca brothers. I send him to Paris with Guy Savoy. He worked with Eric Ripert here in New York. So I wanted him to see how really the upscale restaurant, upscale chefs work for the imagination. So now he's cooking for us in our small restaurant. I have a little restaurant called Rogue. There we only serve...
Where is it?
In Los Angeles. And we only serve 10 people a night. So I have two main chefs, and then I have two or three chefs from our other restaurants. So
wait. Steve, when we go to LA in April, are we going to eat at Rogue? Can you hook that up?
Okay, yeah.
So, but to be fair, your son grew up with Wolfgang Puck, so it's not like as if he started from zero in cooking.
Yeah, no, that might have helped a little bit, or maybe it's a little bit in their genes or something. I don't know.
And then what you did, and then what your son is now doing, is to associate themselves with the best chefs in the world. You were you at a very early age decided, okay, I'm not just an apprentice in Austria. I'm going to go to France, find someone who's going to be among the best chefs in the world. Maybe you didn't know it at the time, but you found yourself apprenticing and learning from. I think part of skill development is attaching yourself to someone who's, let's say, in the top 20 in the world and learning from that person. Do you think that speeds the learning process?
Yeah, no. I think, but for me, more important, you know, I said, I want to cook like this guy is cooking. You know, not only was he a great chef, but he owned a restaurant. At that time, very few chefs owned their own restaurant. You know, they're working for somebody, for some hotel, or for some guy who was in a beautiful suit out in front and like a maitre d' type guy. But chefs were not known to own restaurants. But he was the first one I saw. Well, he's the chef. He owns his own restaurant. I still remember him bringing Picasso into the kitchen. And Picasso looking, I was making a duck sauce and we made it this red color. And Picasso comes up and almost wanted to put his finger to taste it. And I said, no, it's hot. Don't put your finger in here. And he said, oh, but the color is so beautiful. So I think some of these things are still in my head like if it was yesterday.
Well, and you know, that's fascinating because obviously Picasso is sensitive to colors, created 60,000 works of art. So he's sensitive to the nuances of color. And, you know, color also is this expression of nature and how close a food might be to nature. It loses its color the further away it gets from nature. And maybe again, and you speak about the role of color in serving a dish. And maybe discuss that for a second, because I think that's part of how your process works.
Yeah, I think it's a whole combination. You know, it's we eat with our eyes first, so it has to look good.
Not with the nose first?
Yeah, no, first the eyes, and then you smell the food, and then you taste it, you know? So I think to me, it is really important that the food looks good. Now, food looks good to me is not when you manipulate it. If food looks good when it is what it really is, so you can see the essence of what the beautiful green bean is, or a scallop is, or whatever it is. So, I think to me, you don't have to do much. We have to enhance what we do. Obviously, that's what we do in the restaurant. But you want to taste what the food tastes like. You don't want to eat something and say, "What the heck is that?" You know, it is not for me. If I eat a fish, I want to taste the way this fish tastes. So to do that, it has to be really fresh. It has to be cooked the right way. The technique is very important.
I think, and you discussed this in your masterclass, I think the seasonings, because you focus a lot on the seasonings, and yet it's a certain simplicity. You're not trying to change the flavor of something. You're trying to enhance the flavor, I feel.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
So like with I think it's the Branzini class, or one of the classes, it's you just talk about salt, pepper, lemon to enhance the flavor, just the right, you know, amounts of those.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, seasoning is very important to you. So what's... I kind of want to get into something you said earlier about ownership, but I want to hear about seasoning too, because that's like such a big focus in your recipes.
Exactly. But everything is really simple. For example, if you want to season a piece of meat or fish, and like I like pepper, white one, black pepper, whatever it is. But a lot of people, and you can go to your supermarket, you get this ground pepper in a little can. And you know what? The pepper has no flavor. So if you toast the peppercorn a little bit, heat them up in a pan or put them in the oven, and then you grind them, put it in a pepper grinder, and you grind them, you get this aroma, and you say, oh my God, I didn't know pepper can have such a great smell, not just on your tongue, but the whole kitchen will smell like pepper.
But this is how stupid I am. This is the first time I realized peppercorn is pepper.
Yeah.
Like, steak with peppercorn sauce, done. oh, then put some pepper on it. Yeah. I thought it was two different things.
Yeah, no, yeah. A lot of people think, you know, that's where it come, how it comes. Like, I know one of the kids who goes to school with my son, who used to go to school with my son. So he came to our restaurant and he said, is that fish? And it was like a whole black bass, I think so. And he thought, you know, I never see fish like that. I said, so how you see the fish? He says, no, they're always brown and rectangular, you know. So his mother made him
born.
Fish. Yeah, his mother made him fish sticks. So it's he thought that's what fish is all about.
So it's funny how in America, and I guess the world in general, in order to feed a world of 7 billion people, you do have to take shortcuts and process food so as to feed the masses. But, you know, so that kind of removes it from the art form or from the natural ingredients, because not everybody in the world has natural ingredients in their backyard, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think, you know, we can help ourselves a lot. And there is a thing like for fast food, for canned food or frozen food, for sure. You know, how you're going to eat? Not everybody can afford to go to a restaurant. Not everybody can afford really the best vegetables or whatever is really, really just perfect. So I think there is a balance in life. But wherever you can, even today, if you go to Walmart, they have a fresh produce section. You can buy the produce there. Now, that's going to be like the produce like we have here at Cut, for example, where I send it from California, from the farmer's market to our restaurant. No, it doesn't going to have the same flavor if you get it from some of the supermarket, for sure. But I think it's better than not having vegetables at all, you know. So I think there is a certain balance and you have to get the right ingredients if you are not that rich. You know, if you don't have the money to buy, you can get it still a good deal.
You know, and I want to veer in a little into, you know, you mentioned, you know, many chefs don't own restaurants or didn't back then, and it's still true now. And I think that became the seeds of what became a multi-billion dollar business empire plus the success of your brand. But was there ever a point when you were like, ugh, you know, I did cooking for 10 years and now I'm just going to try something else? And you've expressed interest in painting, music. So you're an artist. So have you ever thought like, okay, I did this for 10 years. I'm still in my 20s. I'm going to do something else.
I think I never thought, once I came to America or even in France after working in South of France, I thought this is what I was born to do, you know.
You felt that. How did you feel that?
Because like my whole body, my whole spirit changes when I'm in the kitchen or when I'm at the farmer's market. I tell my wife all the time, I said, you know, going shopping for me to a clothes store or whatever store it is, it's a pain. I hate it. You know, like you walk up and down here, Madison Avenue, and look at all the stores. You know, I don't mind if it's a sunny day just to walk. But then going in the store and trying to find something, I hate that. But going to the vegetable, to the farmer's market or to the fish market, I could spend hours there and it makes me happy.
So let's say I'm 50 years old. I'm working in a cubicle at some big company. I feel mildly unhappy that I spent the last 30 years of my life, you know, paying the bills and just doing enough to get by. And I want to find my, I'm listening to this. I clearly hear the passion in Wolfgang Puck's voice, but I didn't love anything at the age of 14. How do I start to find my love right now?
Well, I really believe if you have a passion for something, if you love theater, if you love radio, if you like TV, if you like to paint or if you like to sing, whatever it is, I think you should work on that really. And if you're passionate about something, you will spend a lot of hours doing it and then you actually can get pretty good.
But you've spent 54 years cooking. Again, I'm pretending to be the 50-year-old in the cubicle. How am I going to put in enough time? I'm never going to be the best in the world, maybe not, but how can I put in enough time that it's really worthwhile to me, that I can make an impact?
Well, I will.
How can I cut the corners?
You know, there is no cutting of the corners. You know, passion is important, obviously, and then repeat and doing things. You know, you can become a chef if you really love to cook, if you really
not
love.
Me. I can't.
Okay. You are the perfect guy for me because if not, we wouldn't have restaurants, if we wouldn't have people like to. I don't want everybody just to cook at home, but everybody has to cook sometimes at home, you know, and do something. And that's one of the reasons I did like the masterclass, because I want people to learn a few basics. And then if you know a few basics, you can do a lot. Like, for example, making a bechamel, which is a cheese sauce, basically. So my mother used to make it all the time. So she put a little butter in a pan with a little flour and then bring some milk to a boil and then put the milk over that and make like a sauce and then add some cheese to it or just a little nutmeg, salt and pepper. And then from there, she made creamed spinach because we had spinach in the garden, or she made macaroni and cheese because pasta was cheap. So, and then just baked in the oven. Now, sometimes we went in the forest, gathered some wild mushrooms. She chopped them up and put them into the macaroni. So it was always a little different. Sometimes a little ham left over. She chopped up the ham and put it in there. So it was not expensive, but it tasted really good. But she knew the basics.
And I love hearing you talk about recipes because that's really where, like, we could talk about billions of dollars worth of stuff, but you're talking about the cheese recipe. It's all ingredients from a 30-foot radius of your house. You just described ingredients that are green, yellow, red, like, and so it's this beautiful panache on the plate. So let's fast forward. You were working at a top chef in France. You must have been learning so much. Obviously, the south of France is beautiful. And then you made, of course, the most incredible decision of your life, which is to move from the most beautiful area in the world to Indianapolis, in the middle of the United States, to work at a restaurant. Why the hell did you do that?
Well, I loved auto racing. You know, Indianapolis is famous for the 500 miles every May they run them. So when I lived,
you're like 22 years old or whatever.
I used to live in Monaco, and I love the Grand Prix they have there, the Formula One race, the Rally Monte Carlo. So when somebody offered me a job in Indianapolis, and I said, "Wow, I have to go to Indianapolis. It might be like Monaco, like Monte Carlo." I said,
"So you were stupid."
Yeah, I didn't look where it was exactly. I know it was somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and then I never looked at the picture or whatever what it can look like. So when I took the Greyhound bus from New York City to Indianapolis, and it took forever to get there. And I said, "Oh my God, where's Indianapolis?" On the card, like I saw at the Greyhound station, they had the map of America. I said, "Oh, it's not that far." But then it took like, I think, 36 hours or something like to get there. And each time I fell asleep, woke up and said, and ran up to the driver and said, "Are we in Indianapolis?" And then I arrived there. I said, "Shit, that's Indianapolis. It has nothing to do with Monte Carlo, so, you know, the south of France." But I had no money left, so I had to start work there. I got my green card there, and I actually had a nice time because the people in the Middle West are really nice. So,
and you probably learned how to basically take that palate, which was very kind of a honed down palate versus what you were used to in France, and kind of make them enjoy. Like, it was probably a pleasure for you to see their pleasure, the differences in the food you were making.
Yeah, but the only thing I hated there was I had to cook all the steaks well done. I think in 1 year, I cooked more steaks well done than in the rest of my career. I said, "Why you want to eat a steak if you want to eat it well done?" And so, but at the end, I have to please the customer. I had to do it. So often, I said, "I'm going to cook it medium. Maybe the restaurant is a little dark. They won't see it."
They won't do it.
The steak comes back and says, "I want it well done." That's not well done.
You mentioned earlier many chefs don't own their restaurants. And I think then, I mean, there was even a movie, Chef, about the conflict between the chef in this movie and how he felt he was an artist, but the owner is so concerned about the short-term pleasing the customer that the chef can't really let his art come out. He can't really choose for himself what to do. And so I think you probably felt that urge early on. You wanted to nobody to tell you what to make. And so you went to Ma Maison, which was the first major restaurant in LA you worked for. Yeah. You negotiated ownership, but then eventually you took complete ownership of your own restaurant, Spago, which became maybe the most famous restaurant in the world from start to now.
Yeah.
What was that urge of ownership? What clicked your business sense in? This is now you went from being chef to businessman.
Yeah, well, I think I always wanted to be in charge of my own destiny. So when I was...
Because most people don't.
Yeah, because when I was at Ma Maison, for example, even I was a part owner, the owner, Patrick, did not really trust me. So he had the...
conflict.
Yeah, it was a conflict, and he was jealous of me too. So for example, when he went on vacation, I didn't sign the check. So that was the old style, you know, everything was handwritten, every order, there was no computers, nothing. But he didn't trust me. And I said, how can you not trust me? I run at least 70% of the business is food. The other one is liquor and wine and so on. So I said, how come he doesn't trust me to sign a check? So I was really very intrigued by that he had somebody else do that. I said, I could look at the check. I know if I bought that or not. You know, somebody else would just sign it without looking at it. And so I always dreamt going back to South of France to Raymond Tullier, the chef at Beaumanière. I said, I want to be like him. I want to own the restaurant. I want to go see the customers in the dining room.
So, and feel like it's your place.
Yeah, so you feel like it's your place and you can do the way you please, really. Now, obviously, you have to make it into a business because if you do the way you please and you have no customer, it won't work. So you have to make the customers happy. And I think that's one of the reasons I love the food, because there's nothing better seeing happy customers coming back years after years after years all the time. So when I opened Spargo finally in January 1982, and it became this huge success. Swifty Lazar did the Oscar parties. We had all the big stars of the old time, from Elizabeth Taylor to Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart, and you name them, they came all to the restaurant.
So let me ask you about that. You start Spago, becomes a huge success. I'm going to ask you about that. But a lot of times people say the success of a restaurant is not based on the food, but based on the Rolodex of the owner. If you can fill it up with the right people in the first few weeks, it gets that buzz and the buzz starts going. Now, ultimately, the food has to stand on its own, but the first thing is the Rolodex. Is that true? Or?
Well, it is partly true in a lot of restaurants, you know, where the owner or the maitre d' has a big Rolodex, the people will come. At the end of the day, to have a sustainable business in the long run, the whole experience has to be great. The food has to be good. The service has to be good. The environment. So to me, it's like an experience. I don't go to a restaurant just to nourish myself. To me, it's an experience. And I think being successful in the long run, if you don't have good food, there are a few exceptions out there in LA too. But for example, with Spargo, which we are open now 36 years, last year was our best year we ever had. Now, you know, in New York, from the Four Seasons restaurant to Lutez to La Caravelle, all these famous restaurants are gone. The mortality rate of the restaurants, I think it's really, really high up there among any businesses. And there's very few restaurants who survive a generation, you know, where the next generation takes them over and they're still successful. And you look at restaurants like Le Cirque, you know, Sirio certainly knew everybody in the city. If the King of Spain came, he went there. Kissinger went there. Actors went there. So they all went to Le Cirque. It was famous for lunch. But then his kids took over, but not really. I think he still was like there all the time. And, you know, they had to close Le Cirque now. So
what do you think? Because like when I think Le Cirque, I do think, oh, okay, a little old school versus newer restaurants. But do you think it's also the fact that the same passions weren't there at the end that were there at the beginning?
Well, I think Sirio got old, and I think the kids, didn't have the same passion. Or sometimes, an owner wants to be so on top of it all the time and doesn't want to give up power to the kids. And I really think, you know, if you have a kid who is 30, 35 years old, I started my restaurant when I was 30, and at Ma Maison, I was the chef and partner when I was 25. So why wait until 40? I think it's important to have, if you have children, if you want them to be in your business, to let them go out and know how hard it is, really, how to make a living. But then when you bring them back, you have to give them the responsibility and show them that they have to take and make decisions. How to run the business part or how to...
That's really hard. It's much different than cooking, or would you say there are similarities? I don't know.
Well, I think in life there are a lot of similarities. And I, for once, you know, like my son hopefully will take over the restaurant. So that's why I send him to great restaurants to learn from other people. Then in about 2 or 3 years, by the time he's 27, maybe I'm going to finance a little restaurant for him. And then he's going to learn how to run one small restaurant. And then maybe he's going to come and work with me in the restaurant.
So I think kind of this apprenticeship aspect, like you're sending him around now. No. First off, you taught him hospitality by sending him to Cornell, a great school for hotels. Then you send him around to the major restaurants so he gets apprenticeships with the greatest chefs. And then you start him off small with his first restaurant before you bring it. What's his first name?
Byron? Yeah.
You didn't name him Johan or something like that?
No. I don't know. We're in America, no. My mother named me Wolfgang because she saw that she loved Mozart. So I think...
And you love music. Like Cut, there's Pink Floyd playing. So.
I know. I love me. I like all kind of music. Like at Cut, when we opened the first Cut, I said, I want to be in charge of everything. So not only just the food and the environment, obviously, the artwork we have in the restaurant, but also the music. Because sometimes I was like at Spago in Beverly Hills, and I said, I don't know why we play this music. This is not something I would play in my home. This is not something I would play for pleasure. It sounds like elevator music. So,
and could you take it? You owned it. Could you take control?
Yeah.
Or you felt
so
like you were
because I owned it, I said, you know what? I love rock and roll. Now, I don't like it to be played like in a discotheque, you know, where you go for dancing, where the beat is so loud that you cannot talk. I want, though, in the background to hear great music. And I still remember when I opened Cut and Bruce Willis came to the restaurant, and then he had a steak. He always ate the bone-in filet, and he had a bottle of Vega Sicilia, expensive Spanish wine. And then he calls me over so seriously and... He said, Wolfgang, and he says, Wolfgang, who chooses the music here? And I said, maybe he doesn't like it. Pink Floyd was playing The Wall. And I said, well, I do. And he says, you know, Wolfgang, there's nothing better eating a bone-in filet with a great glass of red wine and listening to The Wall from Pink Floyd. So I said, oh, thank you.
So it's almost like, again, like you put it, I wouldn't listen to this at home. I wouldn't eat this if it wasn't ingredient around my home. Yeah. It's you're bringing almost the home into the restaurant, and that's part of the success of these things. But at the same time, how do you avoid, you know, you have to build a business, you have to build 100 different restaurants. How do you avoid the micromanaging of these details? Like, didn't someone else want to choose the music? Didn't someone else want to do other things at the restaurant? You can't do everything.
Okay, so let me set you an example. For example, when I opened Cut here and down in downtown in Manhattan, what did I do? So I have a chef, Raymond. He's very talented. If not, I wouldn't have put him here. He's with me for 10 years. And he's like in his early 30s now. So I said, okay, Raymond, here are the boundaries. You have to have some steaks on the menu because this is what we do. But if you go to the fish market, you buy the best fish there is. We don't have to have Dover sole if there is not really the best one, if you have to buy it frozen. Get some skate wings, get some striped bass, or get some black bass, whatever is really good. So you can really invent what you like to cook, the way you like it. You know you trained with me. You know what I like. So don't go out of these boundaries, but go and find the best ingredients possible. So now we have a menu which has its core, which is a lot of meat, but also all the appetizers, the side dishes, the fish dishes, he can do whatever is the best. So I told him, and I tell every chef the same thing. I said, you know, you try to buy the best ingredients and then try not to screw them up. So just enhance them.
So best ingredients, but then also it sounds like you really taught him how to use his imagination within those parameters.
Yeah.
And I bet you he can go a little bit out of those parameters and you would taste it, he would do a good job.
Yeah, you know what? As long as it tastes good. Like he made the last week a skate. The skate is a really good fish, you know, it fits really fresh, a skate wing. And then it was like an Asian flavor. And, you know, did it fit 100% in the concept? No. but it tasted really good. I said, why you don't put it on a menu when it's fresh like that? It was delicious. So I let him to do and express his style a little bit too. But he cannot go out and change the whole restaurant because it has to have a certain core. But the rest, I love when young chefs are inventive. I love when young chefs use their mind. And also, I believe if they have a lot of, if they have talent, I have to give them some freedom to do their own thing because I want them to own the place, you know?
Right, you want them to feel that ownership that you are lacking. Exactly. And that's an important thing. When building a business that's scalable, you still have to give that second tier that you've trained, you have to give them the freedom to feel like owners.
Yep.
And so, but you say it has to stick to the core because there is your name is not just a name, it's a brand, it's a billion-dollar brand. So what is that core? You always have to have a mission statement in some sense, a core statement. What's your core?
Well, for me, my core is always, you know, we are here to make the customers happy. So it is not about me. It is about the experience of the customer. And we have to have a sustainable business. So then, if I train the people right in the front of the house, in the back of the house, or if it's the sommelier who recommends wine, anybody can say, okay, drink a bottle of Chateau Lafite and then spend $1,000 on a bottle of wine. That's not the sommelier's job. The sommelier's job is and comes up to the table or whatever, and if he knows the guests and feels out the guests a little bit and say, I have this red wine coming from Spain, which is amazing. You should try that with a steak. It's delicious. And it's priced reasonably. So you're going to say, oh, God, this guy is really smart. He recommended a wine. It was delicious, goes well with the dish, and it didn't break the bank. So
the core almost seems like bring home into the restaurant, but enhance it, and then have a conversation with the customer. So and show a real care for them. Like, okay, you're going to establish yourself as an expert. Look, we just got this new thing. So wine coming in might be good for you. Don't break the bank. Because if you break the bank, they can't come back anyway. They can't afford it. And you want them, more than them spending money, you want them also to spread the word. And so that their friends come. But
I do the same thing with the chef too. For example, Raymond will bring a big piece of wood and have all the best cuts of meat he just got in, for example, and brings it out to the guest and says, look how beautiful this steak looks, beautifully marbled. And look, this one is from a different part. It might be grass-fed. It comes from Nebraska. And so we have beef come from different places. And so when you look at it and said, oh my God, this looks good. I'm going to have that just grilled over charcoal. We have a big charcoal grill there and just season with salt and pepper. I don't even need a sauce with it. Like, for example, there's a famous French sauce called sauce béarnaise. And I dipped the French fries in there. So I said, I want the taste of the meat. If you buy a good piece of meat, it has delicious flavor. If it's cooked right, seasoned just perfect, just with a little salt and some fresh black pepper. And I think it comes out really, really good. You don't need much. It's simple, but perfect.
It's so funny. There's so many directions we could go, but you love talking recipes. Like, it's great. You could, the sheer love for cooking comes out. So Spago is a success because you have this core philosophy. You've learned through, at that point, you've learned for 16 years how to run a restaurant, how to cook, how to, you know, season, how to use the right ingredients. You're a master chef by this point. You have the Rolodex. How did you, obviously you're a charismatic guy. How did you start bringing in the celebrities? Because, you know, authority, meaning the celebrities coming in, is a great way to drive the next level of people. And you cater the Oscars. Like, you clearly have a deep understanding of the power of authority to drive business.
Well, I think it's also important, not only what you serve, who's coming to your restaurant, for sure, but sometimes you don't know who the people are. You might come to the restaurant and the people might look at you and says, well, I don't know if this guy fits into this restaurant.
Oh, they always look at me that way.
Yeah. So I think it's really sometimes, if you're not famous, you don't know what they might be famous in some other profession. You know, if a famous artist walks in, you probably don't recognize him and who they are because they're not on TV, they're not in the movies, but it's still an important person in their own field. Like, I love art. I mean, except for Andy Warhol, most of the artists, you wouldn't recognize them. People wouldn't know except a very few people. So I think at Spago, when we started out, I remember still when we did the Oscar party with Swifty Lazar, but even before that, all of a sudden, I was friendly with Orson Welles. He used to eat lunch every day with me, like with Billy Wilder, who I loved, the movie director and writer and everything. So naturally, when he came, I cooked him some Austrian dishes, but he brought in Gregory Peck, he brought in Sidney Poitier, you name them. They used to have a table. I remember when I opened Spago, so Billy Wilder has a table of 12 people and all big stars.
So how did he first even know to come to the restaurant?
Like, I knew him from Ma Maison because he's from Austria. So I used to make him as a joke some Austrian dishes like Wiener Schnitzel or like the Kaiserschmarrn or Palatschinken. And he loved that attention and he thought it was something special because it reminded him of his childhood too. And so we formed this bond. I used to go to his house. His wife used to cook Austrian dishes too. She used to cook from my first cookbook. I remember having pork chop with a warm cabbage salad the way we do it. So it was, I think, and for me then really in the restaurant, for him bringing all this famous people in. Now, naturally, everybody was looking and said, wow, look at that. There's Sidney Poitier and Gregory Peck over there. That must be the right place to go. Now, do they know more about food than the other people? Probably not. But they're so recognizable. And I think it helps to establish and make a restaurant successful.
Because so on the one hand, you're looking at every detail, the music, the paintings on the wall, the food, the seasonings, everything, you know, the natural ingredients, everything from home coming to the restaurants. But then you spent years at Ma Maison building these very impressive bonds with the people you loved. It doesn't sound like you went out of your way to bond with people you didn't like. You bonded with the people you personally loved, but they also had status to help you with your next ventures. And now your name itself is a brand. So people say, oh, Wolfgang Puck, I'm going to that restaurant. They may not even know anything about the restaurant, but they'll go, you're the celebrity brand. And you were able to do that. Like, you started doing books, you started catering the Oscars, you've been in so many shows, you know, not just cooking shows, but other shows. You've built a brand and celebrity around yourself. So that's important as well, like kind of aiming your, like now you're doing this masterclass, which is very valuable to people. So building, putting yourself in many different venues is also really important to your business strategy, it sounds like.
You know, it is certainly because of television, you know, all of a sudden, people start to know the chef, what they look like, you know. And I think for me now, when I'm at the restaurant, like even here, so people come up and say, can I take a picture? Because everybody has an iPhone now, so it's easy to take a picture. And, you know, it would be stupid for me to say, no pictures. You know, first of all, they will get upset because I tell everybody no is not an answer. So if I start to say no, the next level of my people who work in the restaurant would say no. So that's
everything comes from the top down in business.
Yeah. And then I think these people are going to go home and say, look at that. I was at Cut in Manhattan and I saw Wolfgang there. Look, I have a picture to show you. And or they tweet it to their friends. So I think to me, it's a whole package, you know. And today, it's a lot. The customer become your publicist in a way because they will tell other people through pictures. And the most important thing is still word of mouth.
Because it's not just that they're trying to inform a group of strangers, hey, go to this restaurant. They look good when they have a picture with you at your restaurant. Like it's their status goes up. So then people want to go.
Yeah, I think it's a good combination. And I think in a way, even sometimes it bothers me if you take a lot of pictures, you know, but it bothers my eyes mostly. But I think when you look at it as a business strategy, it's a good strategy. Why say no when people want really to tell a story about my restaurant? So that way it will bring in more people. And I think that's really an important part. And that's why I love to go to the restaurant. I love to be in the kitchen, but I also like to be with the people in the dining room.
So let's talk about the kitchen for just one second. You love music. You have music playing in the restaurant, but you don't have music playing in the kitchen because you don't want to ruin the focus of all the chefs and sous chefs and so on. How important is this feeling of flow for cooking?
Well, I really believe when I'm in the kitchen, I want to really focus 100% of what I'm doing. So I don't want to be disturbed by anything. There's enough noise already going on in the kitchen. You know, people are yelling and everything is under pressure. You know, everything has to be ready at a certain minute, a certain time. If you have a table of six people, each one orders a different thing. So they all have to come out at the same time, be ready at the same time. So there's a lot of really interesting things going into. You know, people don't know in a dining home how does it happen really. And I think to me, it's like a music, you know, it's like an orchestra in a way. Mm. Everybody has to play to the same sheet of music. Everybody has to know how you want it played. And I think
the chef's the conductor.
And the chef is the conductor. So you have to tell people, okay, I need this steak here. I need the fish for this table. Fire it now because we're going to need it in 10 minutes. You know how long it takes. So it's really a hard thing to put everything together.
And you know, what else, like you obviously, you know, again, were so passionate about cooking, but now it's like frozen foods, hundreds of restaurants. Like what made you, I mean, did you just sort of say, okay, every single reasonable opportunity I'm going to explore and go towards? Like what drove your business empire? Because it became much more than just being a chef. Like you're really more of an empire than a chef.
Yeah. Well, I don't think so. I think my passion is still food, whatever.
Obviously, yes.
But I think it's like building a wall. That's why I maybe like Pink Floyd so much, the wall. You know, it's everything is just another brick in the wall. So every little thing makes the house. You know, it's not one big block. And I think even like now, when I did masterclass, for example, when I talked about them, I said, you know, this will be a good enhancement of our brand, of what I do. But, you know, it also teaches people how to cook at home, how to make better food. So for me, it was a normal extension. So, and you know, and I looked what they did and I saw Serena Williams doing tennis or Frank Gehry about architecture. So I said, you know what? They have really great people teaching other people out there about their craft. And for me, obviously, it's cooking. The good thing is you have to eat every day. So why not make yourself delicious food instead of having just a store-bought sandwich.
And it sounds like mastery for you is bringing in the best elements of other disciplines. Like you just talked about Frank Gehry with architecture, Serena Williams with her craft, Picasso with just looking at colors and art, your own interest in music and bringing that into the restaurant, your own interest in you know, painting and art and visuals. All this together kind of contributed to making you a master chef. I think that's an important lesson in mastery in general is don't just stick to learning chemistry to be a good chemist. Learn the other scientific disciplines. Learn art to become a good chemist.
Yeah, I think what really is important in life is curiosity and the willing to learn and the willing to take some risk. You know, there's always a risk involved in doing something where you need so many people. So
how do you know how much risk to take?
Well, I think I take some calculated risk. I will know how far I'm going to go. So, for example, in the business side, if I would have to finance every restaurant with my own money, it would be very difficult because a restaurant costs a lot of money today. For example, now at the Four Seasons Hotel where Kat is, I had the Four Seasons. They need a restaurant. You know, a hotel needs a restaurant. So we made a deal with them. I own the restaurant. They run the hotel. So it's better for the guest, for the hotel guest, if they come down and go into a great restaurant. They are not the best in running restaurants. They are great in running hotels.
And they know they're going to get your core philosophy of restaurants, even if you've never stepped foot in that particular restaurant. They know it's the people you've trained. Yep. They're going to get your core philosophy. So we can trust that this brand, which translates to the taste of the food, is going to be good.
Exactly. So wherever we open a restaurant, you know, if it's in London or in Istanbul, we manage it. I put my chefs there, my manager there, my pastry chefs there, who worked with me for at least 5-6 years, if not more. Even our chef, for example, in Bahrain, which is a tiny little island in the Gulf there, I have a chef there and a pastry chef there and a sous chef there who are with me for 10 years. So they run two very successful restaurants there. Now, do I tell the chef there, no, you only can cook that? No, I give him certain freedom because I know he understands the people there better than I do here.
I feel there's something about imagination that I'm trying to kind of get my hands around because clearly you're training people not to be just a good chef, but you're training them to have a specific kind of imagination. And like again, someone listening to this, what would be steps to take to improve my imagination?
Well, for example, at our restaurant, Rogue, I bring in the chefs from different restaurants. So they cook for 10 people. They sit right in front of them. What do I tell them? I said, I want you to cook something you never made in your life. You never cooked in a restaurant. This has to be all about innovation. So then when they have to think about it, it's not that easy to think, oh, I'm going to do 3 dishes, small portions, something I never made. So they have to go to the farmer's market or to the fish market, pick up some ingredients, and then think what they're going to do. So now I actually know which chef has more talent, which chef has more imagination, just by doing that. And for me, I didn't start that restaurant that way, but it turned out like a perfect way because now I can evaluate talent. You know, it's easy to talk, but you have to walk the walk. So now at Rogue, when the chef, for example, the chef of Cut in Las Vegas, I thought he was very good administrative. I thought he was very good, a pretty good cook, but not the top cook. But I said, you know, to cook in Vegas, he might be okay at the restaurant. And I needed somebody. So when he came to Rogue to cook, I said, I didn't know this guy had talent and imagination. I was so excited and so happy. What did I tell him? I said, you know what? Put these dishes on your menu or at the bar or in the restaurant. I don't care. But I think you did a great job. So now he went back, put it on the menu. The manager liked it. The guests love it. And I think he feels so proud of it. So now I have somebody there who actually knows what I like. And he builds his own identity also.
And again, how do you... I've been sitting in a cubicle for 30 years, hypothetically. How do I start to build imagination?
Well, I think the good thing is today you can learn techniques online, but I think imagination, you have it or you don't have it. You cannot really teach imagination. You know, you cannot really teach, even somebody's a good musician, but to compose, it's like having imagination. It would be different. You know, it's a different kind of brain maybe than the learning the technique of it. And I think in cooking, it's the same thing. You can learn how to do the techniques. You can learn how to do certain things really through repetition very well. But to have imagination, it takes another part of the brain. And some people have it. Very few people actually have it. A lot of people are good technicians, but with no imagination.
But I feel like if you're passionate about something, you could say, okay, here's a fish with salt and pepper. Maybe I'm going to try, even though the fish comes from, I don't know, Europe, I'm going to try to put some Japanese ingredients in it and mix cultures. And I love these Japanese ingredients on their fish. Maybe that's imagination a little bit, is combining two different things.
Sure. I think that it's certainly an imagination and to please your own taste, which is an important part if you cook. So if you like spicy food, so you add, if you see me making a fish and you say, okay, I'm going to chop some jalapeno really fine and put it in this salsa or in this sauce or whatever you call it and give it the flavor I like. Now, does that going to be a dish which everybody going to say, wow, this is the best thing in the world? Maybe, maybe not. But I think if you don't really have the passion for it, it would be very difficult to go to the next level. But if you really like food, you really like to cook, first of all, you're going to do it more often. You're going to enjoy it more. And you put all your love in it. And I think you have a good chance of making sometimes things up where... You said, oh my God, I didn't know I did it. For example, when I started Spago, I used to make my own smoked salmon. One day, I ran out of brioche, which we serve with the smoked salmon. And we were making pizzas at Spago, you know, but different style, not like the traditional Italian. And all of a sudden, it shot into my head. And I said, how about if I cook the pizza crust, maybe put some onions on it with a little olive oil, make it crispy, and then put the dill cream on top there, and then put the smoked salmon and the little caviar on top. And then I tasted it. I said, oh, this has the yin and yang, the perfect balance, because the crust is warm, it's crispy, the smoked salmon is nice and smooth, a little salt to it with the caviar, and it worked together. And today it's probably one of our most famous dishes.
Yes, I would say it was it is probably your most famous dish. And so many restaurants have kind of copied some version of it, a smoked salmon pizza. And yet I feel with you, there's like an abundance of ideas. You're never worried about some other restaurant taking it because A, maybe it's not going to be as good as yours. B, you'll have more ideas.
Yeah.
So, and it just sort of spreads the brand even further, even slightly. I want to be respectful of your time. I know you're extremely busy. Just one or two anecdotes and a question. Yeah. I know you've built a huge catering business. You mentioned it was like $5 billion a year, hospitals, schools, everything. I remember 20 years ago, I was having lunch with a friend of mine. I forget his name. Fred, who ran Ticketmaster at the time. I forget his last name.
Freddie Rosen.
Yeah, yeah. And he was telling me, just last weekend, Wolfgang Puck came over to my house and cooked. So you started your catering business by going over to the houses of these people and cooking yourself.
Totally, totally. I used to go to like Freddie Rosen, who started Ticketmaster. You're absolutely right. Or Marvin Davies, who run a big oil business and owned Century Fox at that
Paramount.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting. So at the beginning, I went to every house. But now I have people like where everybody knows the chef. For example, my catering chef, Eric Klein, if Steve Wynn calls him up and says, come to my house and cook, and he will go to his house. And he has total confidence that he's going to do a great job. Because I always tell people, I'm not the only one in my company who can cook really well. You know, I have a lot of really great chefs working for me. You know, and for example, here in New York, Raymond, I know he can go to anybody's house. Like he told me, he went on Sunday, he did a little catering for some people we know, and he went there and cooked for them, and they thought it was the best thing ever.
So it's such a great way to start a business by being personally involved at first to see the nuances and then build up from that. And of course, you establish authority by cooking for celebrities to spread word of mouth. The other question I have, which is unrelated, what is the deal with avocado toast? It came out of nowhere. It's $20 on every menu. It's just an avocado spread over a piece of toast. What's the deal?
You know, people read about ingredients that they are good for you or not good for you. So remember, like a few years ago, it was all about kale.
Yeah.
Every menu had a kale salad. Every menu had kale on it. And you said, why all of a sudden kale? But does kale gonna make us live longer? Especially if it's not grown right, it doesn't make any difference. So now all of a sudden, people like in the morning, like in on our breakfast menu, we have avocado toast, and it's the most successful or the most asked or most sold dish we have for breakfast. I wouldn't eat it for breakfast, but
why is that? Because
I don't like avocado for breakfast. I don't mind them in a salad or whatever, but I think people to have that for breakfast, they feel good about it. Now for me, I much rather have a sunny side egg with a little truffle on toast instead of an avocado.
You like your white truffles.
Yeah.
That's your favorite.
And even the black ones too. Now the black ones are still in season, but I love the smell of it. And I still remember, and I can taste it. I was in Italy in Piemonte where the white truffles come from with a friend of mine, with a winemaker. We went to the market for white truffles like at 4 a.m. It was pitch black and everything. He knew the guy where he got them from. They have their white truffles because they don't want to pay taxes on it, so they have them all underneath their jackets and don't show them so nobody catches them. It's almost like drug dealers.
Cuban cigars.
Yeah. And then we went to the house at 7 a.m. to his house, and then his wife made breakfast, and she made eggs with the white truffles, and we had a bottle of great red wine with it. I said, that was a perfect breakfast. But, you know, we got up at
3:30. I'm going to steal that idea. Eggs with white truffles. And red wine for breakfast.
For breakfast.
I'm going to do that before every podcast. So, last anecdote. For the first time in 20 years, I cooked the other day. I hadn't cooked since I was in college. I'm 50 years old. I cooked the other day. And
so there's hope.
Yeah, there's hope.
Yeah.
But first thing that happened was my oven blew up because the previous renters of the apartment, they never cleaned the grease at the bottom. I had never used an oven. So as soon as I put the fish in the oven, the whole thing blew up. I had to go to my neighbor's house to finish cooking it. But maybe this will repulse you, but somebody online at Zabar's down the street told me this recipe because I had no idea what I was doing. Yeah. I bought some salmon and she said, use Dijon mustard, brown sugar, wasabi, and a little bit of, what did she say? Maybe soy sauce? I forget now. But it was okay. I don't know. Does
well,
that
you
sound horrible?
Try, you know, from my online recipe, I think the fish is on there. It's a Veracruz style fish where you could use, for example, you have, most of the people have onion at home. Most of you can get some capers, you can get a little olive, get some bell peppers, maybe some tomatoes in the summer. And you cook and make a sauce out of that. And then you place your salmon on top of that and put it in the oven and bake it. You don't want to bake it too long. You don't want to dry out the fish. It depends the piece, the thickness of the fish, the temperature. I like to cook it at a lower temperature so that way it doesn't dry out the fish. And then you have a good flavor because you have the sauce, you have the juice of the fish who goes into the sauce. So the whole thing mixes together and you can make it for six people, put it in a bigger pan and it's done. So if you have a party, a dinner party or the family, whatever, people are going to say, wow, how did you do that? It tastes so delicious. Well, all you did is make a little sauce out of onions and capers and some tomatoes.
I'm going to do that. Where can I read that recipe?
Well, I think you have it on the masterclass.
So I highly recommend your masterclass, again, where you talk about cooking, specific recipes that are so amazing, your business philosophy and how it's all linked together. And I think people see the beginnings of that in this podcast. I also, well, not only will I recommend all your restaurants, but Cut, which in New York City and LA, wherever. I wanna go to Cut tonight. You think I can get a reservation?
I think for you, I will find a place. If not, I just got an extra table. I push a few tables around. I get you a little.
How do I do? I'm gonna bring a friend. I'm gonna take a date.
Okay, you bring a date. Then you, for sure you're gonna get a table.
Okay, it's not that crowded.
It's very busy. It's good to make a reservation for sure. I think you know the restaurant is full all the time. The bar is great. We have a great cocktail program. If you were just in the neighborhood down there, and a lot of neighbors actually come, a lot of people live around there, they come to the bar. Like last night, I went to the bar, talked to a customer, a fairly young gentleman, and he was sitting there with a lady, and he said, this is the best place to eat a hamburger. He said, I come twice a week. When I want a hamburger, I come to the bar at Cut. It's the best thing.
So, of course, I don't want to take advantage of the fact that you're on my podcast and 300,000 people are potentially listening. But if it's full, how can I use your name to get
it? Oh, you just tell them you're a friend of Wolfgang.
All right.
A few other people might say that too, but it's okay. But you know what is important? You go the first time, then you talk to the manager or you talk to the chef. And then they know you already. Said, give me your business card and your phone so I can call you. Now, it's always easier if you're with a bigger group to make reservations in advance. But if not, once you know the people, it's much easier to get a table. Like, yeah. If you wouldn't say no to somebody, you know already. So I tell everybody when they ask me, what is your favorite restaurant? I tell them it's the restaurant where I'm the best known.
I like that.
And I think that's really an important part. So if you like a restaurant, go a few times, you know, that way people know you and they say, oh, James is coming again tonight. We know what he eats. So then we know what he drinks. So you sit down. And your favorite Negroni or champagne or whatever comes to the table, and they say, thank you for coming. You feel good already.
You're so right. Like I like a restaurant that's about a block away. So for Christmas, I gave all the hostesses a tip just because I'd been going there so much. And I always treat everybody really well. I go there a couple times a week. And now when I call for a reservation, they're like, oh, they recognize my voice. Oh, James Altucher, of course, come on in. Well, we have a table for you.
And if you bring some business people or whatever, so you walk in, they recognize you by your name. Already, you feel better, you know?
Yeah.
Not like if you go to a restaurant and they start to look, what is your name, sir? What is your name? How you spell it and everything? So it's already a pain in the neck from the beginning on, you know? So it's already, you don't feel as good. So I tell everybody, you know, you have to welcome the people like they are in your house.
Do you have your people Google the potential reservation so they know extra about the customers?
I think a lot of them do. I'm not a computer guy, but I think everybody looks for everything, you know, and if they are not sure who is this customer, I'm sure they Google it up, so it's easy to find out about everybody, what people do, and so forth. So I think we also are trying to have a whole system now in our restaurant that, for example, if we have a customer who is in London, he's a very good customer at Cut in London, and then he comes to New York and he wants to go to Cut in New York because they treat him well in London and everything. But then in New York, if nobody will know him, he might not even get a table. So now if somebody calls up, I want them to, they can go on the computer, the name comes up right away, and they said, okay, this is a very important customer from London. Naturally here, they will do the same thing then and say, okay, Mr. So-and-so, just come in. What time would you like to come in? We have a table waiting for you.
I feel like this is a great potential product, a reservation system that not only ties in with the reservation systems of your other restaurants, but maybe ties in with ad networks so we can see what this potential customer has searched for, you know, what his demographics are, what his potential income is, what kind of food potentially he might like, just in case that's available.
I think it's all about the data, you know, all this whole online thing, it's all about data. And I think that way you can serve the customer better. So it is a tool. We don't have the data running our business. We run the business, but the data is a tool to help us to do a better job and make the customers happy.
Well, Chef Wolfgang Puck, I almost feel funny calling you chef because you're so beyond that. But
you can call me cook, it's okay.
Cook?
I tell you one more story. So when I came to Indianapolis, I was like 24 years old, and I always loved auto racing. No, that was actually from Indianapolis. We went to Los Angeles. We go to a club with Niki Lauda because we had a race there in Long Beach. And I go to a club at night. I ask a girl to dance, and we dance. Then the slow dance comes. We dance with her, the slow dance. And then she asked me naturally, what you do? And I said, I'm a cook. She said, a cook? The song was over. She took off. She left me on the dance floor and said, okay, a cook, forget it. I don't wanna be with a cook. And that certainly has changed now. Today, you know, if somebody says, I'm a cook or I'm a chef, no girl will run away because all of a sudden chefs have become a very sought after profession. Cooking has become the thing to do.
Because it's amazing craft and art. And also chefs have become owners.
Yeah. So, and on top of it, all these things on television. You know, help the chef to get notoriety and people know, recognize the face. So, but I think I still remember that scene. It was like in a movie. She said, a cook. And then she took off.
Well, don't take off if you're dancing with a chef. I think that's almost like the name of a song almost. But thank you so much, Wolfgang Puck. This is such a pleasure. And I learned so much and I hope everyone else did. And if you like this episode, subscribe to the James Altucher Show on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again, Cook Wolfgang Puck. I really appreciate it. And
thank you.
I'm going to Cut tonight. So
all right, we'll see you there at Cut. I will be cooking.
Oh, excellent.
You like meat?
I like fish.
Fish? Oh, perfect. I'm going to make you taste a few different fish, like maybe a little skate wing, maybe a little lobster just cooked perfectly.
What's the best time to get there?
Whenever you're ready.
All right.
You tell me when it's good for you, it's good for us.
I love all fish.
Okay, perfect. We have great fish too. You know, normally steakhouse, the fish is always an afterthought, but because I love fish too, and so we have always great fish right from the fish market here.
Thanks so much, Wolfgang.
Thank you.
See you.